Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Jeanette Cockcroft, and I'm the host of this channel. Today, I will be talking with Carolyn J. Smith, author of Season to Taste, Rewriting Kitchen Space and Contemporary Women's Food Memoirs. Please welcome Carolyn J. Smith to the program. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm looking forward to discussing this because this is a really intriguing book on a really intriguing topic. So why don't we start with what's the thesis of this book?
Well, thank you. I appreciate those compliments. That's a good way to get it started off, I think. So basically, I have worked on women's literature for much of my scholarly career. And when I was working on my first book project, which was about chick lit, there was a chapter in there about domestic advice publications. And I got really interested in Martha Stewart and books about food writing and cookbooks and started doing a lot of cooking, which I hadn't done before. And then I was noticing kind of this surge in food writing in the first two decades, between 2000 and 2010. And I started to think about the way in which the second wave feminist movement kind of positioned the kitchen as this space to escape from. And a lot of these contemporary writers were returning to the space of the kitchen, cooking there, writing about that. You know, obviously food blogging was really big at this time. And so I had questions about, you know, why was this shift happening in US American culture? And in what ways were these women writers maybe discussing the act of preparing and consuming food in ways different from women writers of the past? And so that's kind of how the book came about. Just kind of this interest in domestic advice publications that served as a launching point for this bigger project.
Why do you think the 21st century is a moment of interest in food memoirs, particularly women's food memoirs?
That's an excellent question. I think it was just a moment where a lot of things were happening connected to food all at the same time. I talk in my introduction about how, you know, we have this reality television programming about Top Chef, and that really kind of took off. And then we had Michelle Obama in the White House with her Let's Move campaign and her kitchen garden. And so all of a sudden, we were being much more kind of aware of and mindful of and interested in the food that we were preparing and eating. So I think it was kind of a combination of factors. You know, the easy accessibility of the internet and being able to blog about, your experiences with food and share recipes in this new way. So it was kind of like this convergence of, you know, different things happening in American culture that I think led to this surge of food writing.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the intersection of food culture and gender.
Yes. So this is so interesting to me. And I see it, you know, more and more in popular culture. I was thinking about The Bear. If you've watched The Bear on television, it's about a chef, a male chef, right? Yes, super interesting television programming, and coming back at some point in time now that the writer's strike has ended. But this idea of being a chef as male-coded versus being a cook as female-coded, and thinking about, you know, I spent some time in the field of museum studies, and I was at the University of Delaware, where there's all these beautiful historic homes that you can tour and learn about, and kind of where is the kitchen in that space, right? And this private sphere of the home, and then this public sphere that's more masculine coded, male coded. So I think that there's all these ways in which, you know, gender comes into play in the way we think about and prepare food. But I think a lot of what is talked about with women in food kind of skews towards the more negative scholarship about, you know, maybe eating disorders, right? And so I really wanted to examine, you know, the joy of cooking and look at the way in which these writers were really kind of embracing their roles as cooks slash chefs. So that was something I kind of noticed in the women writers I was looking at.
How would you compare the kitchen expectations of the 21st century with the expectations of the 20th century? Sort of the second wave of feminism and the third wave of feminism.
Thanks for clarifying, because numbers are not my strong point. So I'm doing in my head 20th, 21st, right? So that's why I'm an English professor, not a math professor. So I found a lot of the rhetoric with the second wave feminist movement was really about getting into the public sphere, because women had been denied that opportunity. And so there was this time in U.S. American culture where many white, middle-class, heterosexual women were confined to the space of the home. And so I think a lot of the second wave feminist movement, which centered around the concerns primarily of white women, and there's a lot of scholarship about, you know, women of color being disregarded and their ideas and interests. And so there was this real move to get out into the public. And so I looked at Betty Friedan and the way in which her rhetoric really talked about leaving that private space and getting out into the public. And then when we get to third wave, you know, there's a section in my book where I talk about publications like feminist third wave feminist publications like Bust and Bitch, that were really kind of recoding the space of the kitchen in a way that it was, you know, not a place of imprisonment, but a place to be creative and return to and enjoy. And I found a lot of that rhetoric being repeated in the blogs that I looked at and in the memoirs that I was examining. So I think I used the term winking while we bake, which is from the blogger Gluten Free Girl. And she acknowledges in a post on her blog about the way in which the second wave feminist movement paved the way for women to return to the space of the kitchen and kind of enjoy the work that they were doing there, while also kind of acknowledging, you know, what had happened before them, and giving credit to that second wave generation.
This might be a good point to talk about Ruth Reichel.
Yes, Ruth Reichel. So she is such an interesting figure, so prominent and important in the food world. She's written fiction, she's written cookbooks, she's written memoirs, and her work really spans second wave and third wave. And so I used her in the way that I tell my students sometimes it's a good strategy to kind of bookend a project. So, start with something and end with something. And that's what I did in my own book, because, Reichel in her book, Comfort Me with Apples, is really positioning herself as a professional in the food world. She's talking about the writing that she's doing as a food critic. She's referencing a lot of these famous chefs that she's coming into contact with. And so there's a real resistance in that book to the idea of home cooking. It's much more aligned with the professional world. And then more recently, she's kind of shifted her thinking about food and home cooking, and especially with the pandemic, where she was finding herself in her home cooking for herself. And so it's really interesting the way in which her rhetoric changes and embraces this idea of home cook and kind of breaks down some of these binaries that we saw between public and private and chef and cook. And I think I referenced her Twitter, like whatever comes underneath the Twitter that defines who you are. And she calls herself a writer, an eater, a cook. So it's not one identity over the other, but it's kind of embracing this kind of multiple identities as a lot of the writers are doing as well.
You spend some time talking about kitchens and kitchen space, right, as sites of resistance and transformation. I never thought about that. So I think you should talk about that a little bit.
Sure, I'd be happy to. In part, those moments of the book really rose out of the work that I had done at the University of Delaware when I was a teaching assistant teaching for what was then called the Women's Studies program. And each semester that I taught the Intro to Women's Studies class, we read Alice Walker's In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. And just really kind of eye-opening, I think, for my students and for myself about the way in which, women's work has been undervalued. Walker writes about, gardens. And we were thinking about in that class other moments of women's production that might not be given the full credit that it deserves for its creativity. And so I guess that those days kind of planted the seed, if you will, for, this examination of kitchen and kitchen culture. And then my chapter that looks at better homes and gardens and the space of the kitchen. In another life, I will be an architect because I always was very interested in homes and home design. And my first book, I dealt a lot with women's magazines. And so I thought, this book was a challenge to write, and it took me a very long time, in part probably because of the birth of my son and productivity went down a little bit. But that Better Homes and Gardens chapter was really kind of the missing piece. I had everything else and I felt like something was. And so I kind of went back to my roots with magazines and started looking through Better Homes and Gardens and realizing that there were these interesting ways in which the kitchen was portrayed in older editions and then more contemporary editions. And so that kind of laid a nice foundation for some of the analysis that I wanted to do of the food writing in public and private.
Let's talk a little bit about blogging. You describe it as a hybrid form of food writing. So what do you mean by that?
So blogging to me is really interesting in that it embraces multiple genres. And I think in some ways it's pretty elementary the way that I lay it out. Because anyone who looks at a blog knows that it's in reverse order, right? And that there are photos and that there are recipes, right? So in some ways, I felt like I was being kind of obvious in the way that I was analyzing the blogs. But I think when you put that all together, you realize the way in which they are drawing on the tradition of the cookbook, right? And they are drawing on the tradition of the memoir. And there's all these interesting ways in which these conventions of different genres get put together on the blog. And I think to me, what was most exciting about the blogging and the analysis of the blogging was the ability for readers to interact, right? And so somebody might be posting a recipe, and then in the comments, somebody might say, you know, I tried this, but I adjusted it to this. And then the blogger would write back. And then in following a lot of these bloggers on their social media accounts, I began to realize that they too were connecting with one another because of the work that they were doing on their blogs. And so Molly Weisenberg and Shauna James Ahern, who I examine in the blogging chapter, who they're my primary people, you know, they kind of developed a friendship because of the work that they were doing virtually. So it enabled these really interesting real world connections. So I love the hybridity of that, of the blogging and the way in which it kind of takes all these historic genres and mixes them up and messes around with them. And it, that to me seems very feminist too, that creation of the community and the borrowing from here and there. Yeah, yeah.
So this is not an exclusively white middle-class woman's space, is it?
No, no, it is not.
Let's talk about that. That's another part of this that's really intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's what's interesting about the more contemporary writing that I examine is that while you might have had a second wave feminist movement that was focused on white women and white women's concerns, now with in more contemporary times, we certainly hear the voice of white women in food writing more than we hear women of color. But there were some really interesting both memoirists and bloggers that I looked at. And one of my favorites, and she keeps popping up more and more ever since the publication of this book. She's really kind of embraced activism in a way that she hadn't when I was writing the text. And that's the blogger, Jocelyn Delk Adams of Grandbaby Cakes. And she is so interesting to me because she's kind of taking that image of the happy housewife heroine, which was a term coined by Betty Friedan in the feminine mystique, right? Of this woman who just happily prepares and is beautifully dressed. And I think of Betty Draper in Mad Men, who I've also done some research on. And Delk Adams as a Black woman is kind of adopting that persona and recoding it, if you will, in a way that acknowledges a lot of the work that Black women have done in the kitchen. And so her cookbook, which came out of her blog, really uplifts the stories of many generations of her family and the work that they did in the kitchen. And you know, harkens back to Alice Walker's In Search of My Mother's Gardens. And so that was also a really interesting story. And I think one of my favorite parts of the book that I wrote, just because she's such an interesting person. And as I said, she's really getting into a lot of food activism, which I think is super interesting in light of what she's already done too.
Food activism such as what?
I've noticed more and more that she's kind of pairing up and doing different projects with other Black women food writers and trying to elevate their voices. I forget what I was reading recently where her name popped up, but you'll see more and more that she's kind of drawing attention to inequities in the food world and in the publishing world, you know, in terms of who gets their work out there, right? I mean, many of the early food bloggers who got book deals were white women. And so I think Delk Adams is kind of speaking to some of these inequities and trying to help people realize and be transparent about the way in which the industry can work.
How do Julia Malucci and Kim Sune fit into this?
So those are two writers who I felt like were really riding the wave of chick lit, which is what my earlier book was about, young single women looking for love in metropolitan areas, right? But they were bringing in this food element, right? So their stories are very much about the search for love and marriage, but they're doing it through the inclusion of recipes, using food as kind of the organizing structure for their narratives. And so I felt it was important to analyze their work because they serve as kind of a bridge between what was happening in terms of women's literature and where we were now headed. So that was something that I spoke about. And I think the other thing that makes, I'm thinking about Malucci in particular, is that her book is very much about the enjoyment of food. So whereas in those chick lit texts, we have Carrie Bradshaw putting her shoes in the oven, right? Because she doesn't use her kitchen. Now we have Malucci, who is very much invested in the preparation of food for the men that she's dating, but ultimately realizing that she has to be happy in her own space in order to engage in any kind of relationship. And same with Sune. Her book is very interesting. It's very long and involved, and she takes us through this relationship that she has and talks a lot about in this relationship how she was positioned as kind of this housewife to perform for her partner, and it's very much about her awakening. And there's a period of the book where she stops eating, right? And then how she finds her way back to food and cooking for herself. So not just preparing for all of her partner's dinner parties, but really kind of rejecting that relationship and rejecting that previous relationship she had with the preparation and consumption of food, and learning kind of how to love food on her own terms and prepare it for herself.
Now, some of the people listening to this interview might recognize the name Julia Powell.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So why don't we start by your telling us why it is they might feel like they know that name?
So Julie Powell, who sadly passed away recently, I think last year, at a very young age, it was very tragic. And that is my favorite chapter in the book, I will say. I know chapters are supposed to be like children and you don't really have a favorite, but I do love this chapter. You know, Julie Powell is known for, if you recognize her name, you probably know her because of her blog, which chronicled her time cooking her way through Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And then she got a book deal where she kind of made her blog into a narrative. And then we had the movie adaptation starring Amy Adams and Meryl Streep that followed Julia Child's life and then followed Julie Powell's and kind of interwove the narratives. And the second book, which is the book I focus on, I mention her book and all of the media, since it, you know, the media attention to the book and the movie and how that really sparked a lot of interest in cooking and food in the introduction. But then the chapter I devote to her is about her second book, Cleaving, which people really, really hated.
That's interesting. Why did they hate that?
Well, the reader reviews and the reviews in the popular press, I think they were a little disillusioned with Julie's character in the in the first book, it's partially a love story. And I think people were really invested in that love story. And Cleaving is about the dissolution of her marriage. And her, you know, she has an affair. She chronicles her affair in very vivid terms. But what she does in that book with meat eating and butchery, and the way she becomes an apprentice for a butcher as a way to get some distance from her husband and to learn a skill that she had always wanted to do. And I feel like that book does some really sophisticated things with the male-coded industry of butchery and her entering into that space. And then also there's been some really interesting feminist scholarship about women being equated to animals. So the way in which she's kind of talking about herself and her relationships and her body and the butchery, I think it is super interesting in terms of all that scholarship that's been done about women and animals. So
let's explore that a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In that chapter, I draw a lot on Carol J. Adams' book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. And Adams kind of shows the way in which advertising will tend to put women in these kind of animal-like positions. And I talk about how even today we see this equation of, you know, animals and women and advertising in popular culture. And I think I referenced, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but it was an excellent series on HBO by the author Gillian Flynn. They adapted her novel, and there's moments where we see animals and women just kind of completely being, you know, transferable for one another. And so the violence against animals, violence against women, a lot of that was coming up in Powell's narrative. And she will often refer to pieces of meat in a way where she's equating them with her own body. There's these brilliant little illustrations at the beginning of each chapter that kind of show dissections of meat. And then there's one of a human where it's labeled like you would see, you know, a cow labeled or a pig labeled. So just really, I feel like a sophisticated kind of meditation on issues of power and food, vegetarianism.
Yes.
I love that book. So even though the critics didn't like it, I think it does a great job.
Before we finish up, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I am currently a professor in the writing program at the George Washington University, where I teach all first-year students all the time in the freshman composition class. I find it so fun and lovely because they come in and they're full of so much enthusiasm. And my students have really been, you know, I thank them in my acknowledgments because I had taught a class on food writing and I felt like we were all learning together about these interesting gender presentations. So a lot of my classes deal with issues of feminism, of women and popular culture. Taught a class on romantic comedies. Right now I'm teaching a class called Communicating Feminism. I'm in the midst of grading all the papers and there's some really brilliant ones. So it's exciting. And I live in Washington, D.C. with my husband, who is also a professor, but he's biologically minded. I am humanities minded, and our son, and then our two dogs, who, as I explained to you, are at the groomer so that they didn't disrupt this interview.
Where did you go to school?
So I went to a very small undergraduate school called Moravian College. It's now Moravian University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is where I was born and raised. And then I ventured down the pike a little bit to University of Delaware for my graduate work, where I had the opportunity to work with people in the Women's Studies program, in the Museum Studies program, and then my primary discipline was English. So,
okay. Now, before I let you go, tell us what you're working on now.
Oh, I was kind of dreading this question because the book came out in June. I was taking a little break, but
fair enough.
But I am actually working with a dear friend of mine who's at the Savannah College of Art and Design. We are co-editing a collection about the contemporary heroine. So there's a lot of reboots right now. If you think about Wednesday Addams, or the Archie comics with Riverdale. So we put out a call for papers on the rebooted heroine, got some excellent essays. And so we are putting those together and hoping to find a publisher and get that work out into the world. That's been really fun to work with Kate Newell on that.
It sounds wonderful. I look forward to it. Well, I'm going to let you go. I think we've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so very much for a really great discussion
about it. Thank you.
I absolutely enjoyed this book, so really appreciate your time.
Good. I'm glad. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk about the things that I love. So
absolutely. Thank you.